Okay, good morning, everybody. It is July 15th. It is 11 a.m., and this is the monthly meeting of the District of Columbia Board of Ethics and Government Accountability. I'm Robert Spagnoletti. I'm chair of the board, and with me today is Carol Schwartz, the other board member. There are two of us present, which constitutes a quorum, so we are able to conduct business today. We are located in room 540 South, excuse me, on Judiciary Square, here in Washington, D.C. We are technically vacant three members as a board. However, the mayor has nominated two. They have both been confirmed, but not yet sworn. So we are still two in the quorum of two. But I would like to recognize Shamari Wade, who is present, who is one of those nominated and confirmed members, and will be sworn on Monday if all goes well. So thank you for being here. We look forward to you being on this side of the table as opposed to that side of the table.
I'd like to welcome you, too. And I did come to my first meeting and sat out there, too. So it was kind of an interesting
and there was no first
to be
meeting
there, and then the next meeting to be here.
There was no meeting before I was sworn. Which,
that's
by
right,
because
you were an original.
Which, by the way, happened 4 years ago this week. So, okay, so an agenda was posted in accordance with the Open Meetings Act, unless there are any changes, we can adopt it by consensus.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Let's go ahead then and move right away to item four, a report from the Director of Open Government, Ms. Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome to our board member, Mr. Wade. Training. Since the last BIGA meeting, the OOG has conducted three FOIA trainings. One of the trainings conducted on July 21st was a combined training with the Mayor's Office of Legal Counsel and the Office of the Attorney General. The training offered updates on the Freedom of Information Act that was handled by the Office of the Attorney General. The Mayor's Office of Legal Counsel provided training on the appeals process and a recent notable FOIA cases. Tina Curtis with the Office of the Attorney General conducted a short session on privacy laws that FOIA personnel should be aware of in their review of records. The OOG conducted one-on-one FOIA trainings for the Alcoholic Beverage Regulation Administration and with the D.C. Water and Sewer Authority. The OOG conducted five Open Meetings Act trainings. Two of the Board of Medicine, two were with the Board of Medicine, first with their executive staff and its members. And then we conducted two combined Open Meetings Act and ethics trainings arranged by the Mayor's Office of Talent and Appointments, and one training of the members of the Alcoholic Beverage Regulation Administration Board yesterday.
That's a lot of training for 1 month.
It's a lot of training.
It is.
So as you can imagine, as a result of all the trainings, the request for FOIA and Open Meetings Act advice increased.
Of course.
Mr. Barton and I have fielded 22 informal inquiries for guidance. On June 28th, the OOG received a complaint alleging that the Office of the State Superintendent of Education is in violation of the Open Meetings Act for convening without proper notice a meeting of a task force to review the uniform per pupil school funding formula. OOG requested the state superintendent supply the records by July 13th so that the office can conduct a full review. OSSE has failed to respond. OOG will issue an advisory opinion and demand for records to OSSE today. Just as we were sitting here, the chief of staff sent over an email saying she realized she missed the deadline. So we're going to respond to that email with the advisory opinion and the demand letter. Just so that the board is aware, it will include language that the Office of Open Government is reserving its authority to seek injunctive relief in D.C. Superior Court. Public outreach. At the request of the EOM, the EOM's Office of the Secretary, the OOG hosted a delegation from the country of Georgia. The delegation of 10 people included elected officials from across the country interested in hearing about the Office of Open Government and the purview of this board. Right. On June 23rd, I was sworn in officially for the second time to the mayor's Open Government Advisory Group.
That's good.
The first charge of the group will be to recommend an open data policy to the executive. The group is chaired by the chief performance officer under the city administrator's office and includes private sector and agency representatives. The mayor's general counsel is also part of that group. She announced at the meeting last week that the mayor had released on July 8th body camera video footage of a police-involved shooting, and that was done proactively, I might add. OOG is launching a newsletter. Mr. Barton has taken the lead on drafting it. The newsletter will be sent to FOIA officers and to the points of contact assigned to boards and commissions in the central calendar. It will include updates on the Freedom of Information Act and tips for compliance with the Open Meetings Act.
That's great.
On July 6th, I testified before the Committee on Housing and Community Development concerning Bill 210697, the Advisory Neighborhood Commission's Omnibus Amendment Act of 2016. This bill would make several significant changes to the operation of ANCs, including excluding ANCs as an agency, thereby removing them from the requirements of the Freedom of Information Act and allowing ANCs to vote by secret ballot. I, of course, testified against both provisions in the bill and offered the services of the Office of Open Government to create the same central calendar for ANCs to reduce the burden of FOIA requests. Chairperson Bonds is sponsoring that bill. I reminded her that she is currently also co-sponsoring the Strengthening Transparency and Access to Open Government Amendment Act.
I'm sure she appreciated you pointing that out to her.
That would bring ANCs under the requirements of the Open Meetings Act and suggested that she pull language from that bill and incorporate it into Bill 210697 so that ANCs, as public officials, are required to follow the same rules as boards and commissions. I'd like to add that both she and her staff members seem very receptive to the option of creating that same central calendar for ANCs.
Excellent. That's the one.
And, of course, I reiterated that it's can be used by the most technically challenged of people.
Right.
So she seems to be on board with that.
It was the Mayor General Counsel that had raised it as a possibility, which was great.
Right.
The other thing, I will also say that I did get some informal feedback about your testimony, which was extraordinary. It was very positive that you had done a terrific job in pointing out some of those things.
Always. Gottlieb Simon.
Comprehensive.
Right. Gottlieb Simon also testified that he provided a FOIA guide to ANCs. I recommended that since the Office of Open Government oversees compliance with FOIA, that it be allowed to conduct a FOIA training of ANCs during their orientation. The entire written testimony is, of course, on the Open Government website. And also, there was a press mention of my testimony in DCS, so. Although minor, there was at least a block hit on that. There is still no word from the Committee on the Judiciary and Public Safety on whether it will set a hearing on the Strengthening Transparency and Access to Open Government Bill. It is my hope that now that President Obama has signed into law the FOIA Improvement Act of 2016, that the Council will be encouraged to follow suit and set a hearing date. The federal law now requires a consolidated online FOIA request portal, sets a minimum of 90 days for requesters to file FOIA appeals, and gives the Office of Government Information Services, which is the federal counterpart to OOG, the authority to mediate FOIA disputes, all of which we have called for in the bill that is currently before Chairman McDuffie's committee. I've notified his staff of that bill, and I'll just keep my fingers crossed that it'll inspire some movement now that they're not creating anything new. No.
Right. Yes, let's hope
that
so.
That concludes my update.
Because on the ethics side of the House, they also have the comprehensive code is pending as well before that committee. And so they have their hands full. But it's all stuff that's designed to ensure ethical, open, and transparent government. So we're hopeful that the committee will take this up in September when the Council comes back. So.
Great.
But it's a very busy month. I thought the summer was supposed to be
slow. It's more like 5 weeks. So.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Any questions? Sir?
No, thank you.
Great. All right, so let's go ahead and move to the report from the Director of Government Ethics, Mr. Sylvan.
All right. Well, good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Welcome to Mr. Wade. We look forward to you joining the dais. All right, so let's go through the agenda. Item number 5A, update on status. Recap of the previous month's activities. So we start with the stats. Last month we opened 11 investigations. This month, thankfully, we only opened two. We closed four, and that means there's currently 8 investigations open. Last month there were 16 open. We stayed only three more. So now we have a current stayed case docket of 20 cases, which is actually kind of high, but they're for various reasons.
Right, and there's a big group of them that all fall in the same category, as I understand.
Yeah, and for those that aren't familiar with why we stay a case, it's because either another law enforcement body is undertaking the investigation, or it's in a court proceeding currently, or in a few cases, the law is been the law that the part of the code that potentially has been violated is under review by the council to be changed.
And so, we've done that out of fairness.
Yeah, right. We did that in fairness to folks.
No, and I'm glad you repeat that, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Executive Director, because I think it's important for people to understand that we're just not sitting on cases to be sitting on them, that there's real reason for it.
Absolutely.
Okay, publication and reporting obligations. The third quarter complaint report was filed. It was published on our website on July 6, 2016, as required by DC Official Code 1-1162.20B. Training outreach. Our attorney, Ms. Cooks, with the assistance of Mr. Kitab of the Office of Open Government, has been working to improve our website. Do we have a moment to? No? Okay, so next month we're going to have a demonstration as to some of the improvements. And at that point we should have the full board.
Absolutely. That'd be great.
Okay.
You realize you have a high bar with Ms. Hughes sitting over here.
Absolutely.
Right? I'm helping out. I'm kind of supervising quietly on this end. It'll be fine. Great.
Ms. Cooks is also organizing this year's Best Practices Symposium at the UDC David A. Clark School of Law. In addition to the regular evening 2-hour-long panel discussion, we'll be expanding the program to an entire day of ethics training in open government, FOIA training classes for interested government employees. Much like the federal government, which holds an ethics summit each year, this will give employees the opportunity to select one or more of our specialized trainings throughout the day. The trainings that will be offered include full 2-hour ethics training, open government FOIA training, post-employment, Hatch Act, and a new gifts training module we're putting together.
Good.
We're also thinking of inviting our colleagues in the Inspector General's office and the Auditor's office to present whatever they think is important for government employees. So we'll be reaching out to them shortly.
That's great. And we appreciate Dean Broderick and the school, of course, for letting us use their facilities to do all of this, which is great.
And may I ask when that is going to be?
October 20th.
October 20th, okay. And are we welcome to come by?
You're expected.
We're expected. Okay, well,
hosting.
We're hosting. See, I didn't know that I...
The symposium piece of this is actually substantially for our benefit, because we are going to be hearing, in particular this year, more information about recommendations about how we deal with government contractors. And the role that we're going to play. And there's a bunch of pieces that we'll be discussing between now and then, as well as, and I suppose we hear from the people who know best about their best recommendations about what practices we should adopt, what legislation we should propose to give us greater, and the ability to hold government contractors accountable to our code of conduct. So that's going to be the focus, and it's for us.
Okay. Well, good, because I know most of the training sessions you all do individually, and so that's why I asked.
This
certainly sounded like one I wanted to be at, and I'm glad I'm supposed to be.
You are indeed.
I was going to be there regardless.
There you go.
We have Mr. Grimaldi has actually secured one of the speakers for that evening, and so we're very excited to have that person, an expert in government contracting, right?
Right.
Okay. And we're looking for one or two others, so if anybody has any ideas, please let me know.
I think it's important with the government contractors, because more and more they're being used, and so they're like employees, and they're paid for by taxpayers' money, so they should abide by the same rules.
Indeed. All right. So attended by staff, trainings, three. We continue to try to improve our legal writing within the agency, and so in that respect, our attorneys participated in a training called the Winning Brief, which is a series conducted by Brian Garner, another entitled Write Readable Sentences, another one entitled Master Phrasing.
How was the Brian Garner training session? Was it?
I'll put it to the folks that attended it.
The reason I ask is because I get an email from him every single day, and I was just wondering whether, having been through one of his courses now, you thought that it was helpful, worthwhile.
I think we all agree that it was helpful. I took the one in person, and right. I also did the webinar with my colleagues. The one in person was more in-depth, so I would definitely do in-person over
the online, right. That's almost always the case, but it's good to hear, though, that it was helpful.
Mr. Grimaldi attended an ADA training session, Americans with Disabilities Act, since he is our agency ADA coordinator. And Mr. Flowers attended the annual meeting of the Uniform Law Commission, where, as I understand it, he presided over the Council of the Whole. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So,
is Jimmy Shea still there? Is he still part of it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm just wondering.
And so, just to mention, in the next 2 weeks, our investigators, Mr. Cook and Ms. Corrales, will be attending a two-week-long, highly intensive investigator training program that's being offered by the Inspector General, the Inspector General's office. It's really very generous that he's allowing us to join. I mean, it's a very expensive program. It's intensive. It includes field operations training, indoor-outdoor classroom work, and at the end of it, they get a certificate. And so our investigations may slow down for the next 2 weeks, since two of our three are going to be employed full-time.
But it's very worthwhile. I'm glad that the Inspector General is including us. That's terrific.
Oh, that's great.
Some of our attorneys will be attending some of the sessions as auditors, just auditing the class, but that'll be just on a couple of days. Conducted by staff, we did 16, two more than last month, which is surprising given the intervening holiday that we had with July 4th. This included two-hour monthly ethics trainings, two new employee orientations, two MSS trainings, six board and commissions trainings, including three regular presentations to new board members, two at the Board of Medicine and one at the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. We conducted a training session for the entire staff of the Office of the Inspector General, one each for the Executive Office of the Mayor, the Office of the City Administrator, and the Office of Unified Communications. And I have to say, it wasn't me. The staff really stepped it up because I was off for a week, so I really do appreciate their efforts doing that. Thank you. All right, advisory opinions and advice. At the last meeting, I mentioned that the mayor's office had requested an opinion from Vega concerning permissible statehood initiative activities by government employees. Mr. Grimaldi undertook to draft that opinion, and we got it out the door in record time in a few days, and that opinion was published on July 1, 2016, in the D.C. Register.
Right.
Mr. Grimaldi, you want to take a moment and just recap the conclusions that we reached?
Yeah, essentially, and the board members have a hard copy of the opinion. There was, in the request, a raft of activities related to this now council-approved advisory referendum that'll be on the November ballot. And essentially the question was, all of these activities comport with certain critical elements of the code of conduct. We chose to focus on that one element in the Comprehensive Merit Personnel Act on refraining from taking any conduct or official action that would adversely affect the confidence of the public and the integrity of the district government, the misuse of government resources, and then, of course, the Hatch Act. And we found, for reasons that are in the opinion, that the activities passed muster.
Yeah, I saw the opinion when it came out, and I thought it was very thorough. I also saw Office of Campaign Finance's parallel opinion, not so long, not as long as this, but also concluding that they were able to use the resources that they were authorized for purposes of the state of activities. So, and I see that it's going to be on the ballot, so
yeah, right.
They're moving.
Okay. Informal advice. We've fielded 72 inquiries since the last meeting, down from 81 last month. Again, though, this does not include the advice queries that were answered in connection with the lobbyist and FDS filings, of which there were many. Ethics legislation, comprehensive code of conduct. On Tuesday of this week, the council passed Bill 21334, the Procurement Integrity, Transparency, and Accountability Amendment Act of 2016, which, according to the accompanying committee report, is intended as a comprehensive update of the district's procurement laws. The bill was introduced by council members but incorporates certain provisions of a procurement-related bill, Bill 21397, that had been introduced by the mayor. Both bills were referenced in last year's best practices report and served as part of the basis for the board's forecasting the theme of this year's BPR, Vega's future role in district government contracting. Significantly, Bill 21334 preserves the district's ability to contract out certain government functions, otherwise known as privatization. Privatization, to the extent it already exists, results in contractors from a private entity working alongside district government employees, performing essentially the same functions, but not being subject to the code of conduct. That issue and how to address it will be a central theme of the symposium in October. Regarding the comprehensive code of conduct, Brian, Jack, and I met with a Judiciary Committee staffer to review the update on the bill that you approved last month. The staffer didn't have any questions, and it otherwise appeared that she was still early in the process of reviewing the legislation. However, in a follow-up email, she said that the committee was aiming for first reading of the bill in September. On a related note, Mr. Grimaldi also spoke with the staffer about Bill 21-124, Councilmember Maydeau's bill that captures the, quote, no-brainer, end quote, recommendations in the 2014 Best Practices Report. For example, eliminating the requirement that the Best Practices Report contain a discussion of the same specific questions each year, providing for appeals from board orders to the Court of Appeals rather than the Superior Court, and enlarging the time to file lobbyists' activity reports. In short, the committee is still actively considering the bill, along with others that would impact Vega. Current thinking is to pick and choose between the bills and incorporate selected provisions into the Comprehensive Code of Conduct.
Right. Well, let's hope that that schedule holds for first reading in September.
Yes, I know. Item F, rulemaking changes to the rules. Last month I reported that we were finished working on, we had finished our working sessions and were in the process of producing a redline version of proposed rule changes. Unfortunately, given the press of other business, we still have not been able to make measurable progress on these rules. We'll get back to it. Try to have something next month.
That's fine.
On the budget, there are no updates with respect to the budget, except that we...
Except that we're not broke.
We expect to spend down both personal service funds and non-personal service funds almost completely by the end of the fiscal year. Staffing, item H, we are fully staffed, thank goodness.
Well, I understand that Mr. Burns stopped by to say hi.
Yes, he did, and I expect to see him...
Pretty well.
Yeah, he's doing fine, and we expect to see him at the cookout on July 30th at Mr. Grimaldi's house. And I hope everyone can be there for that. It's always a fun occasion. Lobbyist and financial disclosure matters. I'm going to let Ms. Pat Selt address.
And I see we have a repeat, if you will.
So we have one waiver in front of the board today. It is a repeat offender client in this case, In re Crown Castle. So last month we dealt with a fine that had been imposed on Crown Castle for failing to timely file their July 2015 activity report. This month they have been fined for failing to timely file their January 2016 activity report. They sought a waiver of the fine on essentially the same bases that they sought a waiver of the July 2015 fine, which is that it's their first time filing with the district. They had several employees who had responsibility for filing the lobbyist activity reports, and it fell through the cracks. We opposed the previous waiver request, but understood there were some mitigating factors in specifically that Crown Castle had not done any lobbying in the time period for which the activity report was. The case is different with the January activity report. Lobbying did actually occur.
$11,000 worth of lobbying.
Exactly. It was reported by their lobbyist, and so we oppose this waiver request.
Yeah, and I have to say that it is a little odd to have a request from the lobbying compliance manager, having already been through this once before.
And it's amazing how they have time to, you know, put in the request for a waiver, but not the time to file the report. I think maybe they should better utilize their time.
And for all the reasons outlined in the director's response and opposition, I would vote to deny the waiver.
And I would agree to deny the waiver.
Got an order, order here that I will sign. And I will note it is now July 15th, which means we've just passed the deadline for the July filing of activity reports, which just means, Mr. Wade, prepare yourself for the avalanche of waiver requests that will show up beginning in August. The maximum fine, by the way, is $300, just so that we're clear about what we're talking about.
Yes.
It adds up.
but that's the amount of money they spent on law firms to write the letter requesting the waiver.
Be cheaper.
There are other issues at play there, but purely financial.
$300, whatever it comes to.
If they just file on time, it makes life a lot easier.
So speaking of that, you are right. This last Monday was the July filing deadline. It was Monday because the 10th was Sunday,
right.
Even though statutorily
an extra day.
Yep. On Tuesday, July 12th, we sent out notices via email to any of the lobbyists who had not yet filed their activity reports, lobbyists and clients, I should say. The letter indicated that there was a $10 fine would be imposed for each day any report was filed late, given that all of them may have different timelines.
Sure.
Fines have been imposed as to whenever they submitted something. We had several replies that indicated their people were having some sort of issue with the filing system, and after some research and work on behalf of our Jessica Dillion, our administrative assistant for lobbying and financial disclosure, we discovered that many of the people who seem to have had what they presumed to be technical issues actually thought that they had to register twice a year, and
as opposed to filing an activity report.
Yes. So that is where the whole problem seems to have come from. We're working on resolving those, hopefully, without having to present waiver requests to the board.
Excellent.
Yes. Yes.
We do appreciate that.
Yes. But other than that, the electronic filing system continues to work pretty well.
Boulder along.
Yes.
Good. I mean, this is the first year we're mandating this, so there are bound to be a few bumps in the road, but I'm glad that it's by and large.
Yes, we certainly had less in this July 2016 filing period than in January, less lobbyists who tried to submit paper reports and say they were not aware of the electronic filing requirement. So.
And also, it's got to take some weight off the staff to not have to deal with it. So.
Oh.
Not that it stops the questions, but at least that's got to be helpful. Excellent. Financial disclosures?
Yeah, so financial disclosure. Mm-hmm. We obviously now we're in mid-July. So Clara, our wonderful auditor investigator, has started conducting a review of all of the public financial disclosure statements that were submitted as of June 24th. So she's gone through and we're in the process of working with her and our investigators and our other attorneys because she's identified six public filers who disclose various descriptions of gifts from outside sources.
Right.
So we want to look into these, analyze them, figure out whether or not it's a violation of the code of conduct. Similarly, going back to the public filers, we also sent notices of noncompliance to the public filers on June 13th. We sent notices via U.S. mail and email to hopefully have our best chance of reaching them.
Yes.
No fine was imposed in these letters. It was a letter notifying them that they had been flagged as having failed to file and that they needed to come into compliance.
Right.
So we also are in the process of going through the list of non-filers and figuring out who is a current government employee and who is a former government employee so that we can still try to reach out to people via the phone or whatever it is.
And I know I've said this before on other occasions, but I will commend OG for its patience in trying to get folks to file without immediately dropping the hammer on them, because obviously if they don't file, they should be fined.
There's approximately 185 non-filers right now. We don't know how many are former government employees.
Right.
We suspect that it's
but that
the
number,
majority.
The mere fact that it's all, was it 3,000 public filers,
roughly,
give or take? So the mere fact that we have only, I say this in all deadly seriousness, only 185 that we have to sort of figure out, given where we started out with this process, is nothing short of miraculous.
Well,
because the first year, as I recall, we were well into the fall when we were still chasing down, okay, like hundreds and hundreds of people who hadn't filed.
It's our goal to have 100% current government employee compliance
right.
by the time we meet in August. And we've already started that process. We're having DCHR identify who are the current employees and who are the former employees.
You guys do a great job with it. I know it's a tremendous amount of work. And, I mean, the agencies really should do their share in keeping track of their current and former employees when it comes to this kind of stuff. But you do a terrific job about trying to get folks in compliance as opposed to being a gotcha organization. So again, I commend you for doing it, and the fact that you're under 200 is nothing short of astounding. Astounding.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to talk a minute about the, you know, looking at the ones who had reported gifts to check on those. I also want to say it's very important that people that do get gifts report them, but oftentimes, and now we're looking at those gifts, but what about people who maybe work in the same office and who maybe went to the same events that would be considered gifts because they cost that amount of money, what is it, $100 or more, is considered a gift if they go to an event?
Like a widely attended gathering?
Yeah, a widely attended gathering that costs a ticket and they get the ticket for free.
Right.
That's considered a gift, correct, if it's $100 or more?
That's not something they have to report because under the widely attended gathering rule, if you meet all the criteria for going to one of these things, it's in your interest of your agency, part of your duties and stuff like that, and you go to this event, then the price of admission is not considered a gift. It's not considered a gift. So, but you're right. For every one of these, there does need to be a written record that they received this, they don't file with us, they file with their agency, and that the person is allowed to go because it's part of their regular duties.
But what about, let's say, that one person in a certain category got a gift from someone that was $100 or more? Is $100 still the...
It's $10 for prohibited sources.
Okay.
If you get a
gift
more than $10 from a prohibited source, it's improper unless it meets one of the exceptions to the rule.
All right. Let's say they went to the event and they were given a gift, like a wallet or something. It was something. And then if they're the same people that went to the same event and one got the wallet and one didn't, you know what I mean? So I wonder how we find out who's getting the gifts and not reporting them. Being that we're going to look into the gifts of people that reported them because we want to see what those gifts are and for what purpose and all of that. But what about the people that may be comparable? Brian, when you worked at the D.C., and if you went to something and you got a gift, it's would be that other staff members from the council had gotten that gift. I'm just using that as an example. And because it was a gift they gave out at that event that was over $10 or another event or a luncheon or whatever, not a huge gathering event. I just want to make sure that the people that are reporting the gifts, and I like the fact they're reporting them, that we're now going to look at what those gifts are and why and blah, blah, blah. But what about the people that are in a comparable position?
Who are not reporting the gifts.
Who are not reporting the gift.
That's a problem.
That's a problem.
We hope the mandatory reporting requirements trigger.
Well, but sometimes they don't work. I know as a council member, I went to different things. I received certain things. I always reported them. And then I'd look at other colleagues that were at the same event, got the same thing I did. It might have been. And yet they didn't report them.
It seems to me that in that scenario where we have an employee who reports a gift, it turns out to be improper, that will trigger an investigation here, right, because you'll be auditing those. And then the event that led to or the person that gave the gift, it seems to me in the context of that investigation, the question can be asked of the person.
Well, I think it should be. The point I'm making is that I don't want to just say to the people that report a gift, all right, we're going to really look into it. That's only going to encourage other people to not even report gifts. And there are too many now that don't report them.
I would also say that to the extent that the majority of the problems, and again, we're talking about six people here, so of people who self-reported gifts, and we don't know what at this moment, but let's assume for a second that some of them are prohibited sources, most likely contractors, right, or someone trying to seek business with the district government. That's exactly the conversation that we're having in October about how we touch on those folks, what powers we should have, how we enforce, what can we do to enforce, who should have primary responsibility, what elements of the code of conduct should apply to, that should be required to be part of a contract with the district government and stuff like that.
And but, maybe looking at comparable employees that didn't report a gift a little deeper.
Right, but, and again, we have to,
absolutely,
and, you know, keeping in mind what, sort of where our, what our mission and our resources are, because there may be the Inspector General as a resource as well, because they have over.
I just mean somebody minding this store.
Right.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep. Nope. I have no problem at all with when we pull someone in and say, you got this gift at an event. Was anyone else there with you from your office? I'm happy to ask that.
And who gave, and then who gave it? And then ask the person who gave it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who else did you give them to?
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sure.
Just to report on the confidential filers, so the other side of the coin here, we have all agencies now, they are required under the rules to submit to our office what are called confidential filer review reports. It's essentially a form that comes from the agency that says you have received the confidential filer statements from everyone at your agency and you have gone through them and looked to see if there are any issues. What they do then is if they see issues, they report them to us, and then they send us copies of whichever confidential filers forms they think present an issue or just seem to look odd, whatever the case may be. Clara, again, is helping us review those, and she has done a preliminary review of the ones that were submitted as of June 13th. They were due on June 1st. There are still some outlying agencies who have not submitted them, who we are tracking down to get those in. But she has gone through, there are about 18 confidential filers reports that have been flagged by various agencies. So she's in the process of going through those. And like I said, they are flagged for a variety of different reasons. Someone reported outside employment and they want us to look into it to make sure it doesn't present a conflict of interest or gifts or the form was not completely filled out properly or one of many different things. So we're in the process of conducting an additional technical review and reaching out to the agencies to get more information on those filers.
We also have some non-complying agencies who have not given us their reports that we're working on now.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that finishes it for financial disclosure.
Thank you very much.
We have one.
We'll be seeing you again with the waiver requests, I'm sure, in a few weeks.
We have one non-confidential.
We do. So I'll take the lead on this. The matter that we're talking about is In re Jaron Price. It's case number 1426-001. In this matter, last month, the board issued a notice of violation on June 9th. We issued it charging Mr. Price with three violations of the code of conduct, two counts of directly or indirectly making a hiring decision regarding a position within his own agency with respect to a relative, and one count of failing to file a written recusal, all dealing with the hiring of a sister-in-law within the Department of Employment Services. Today we are going to set a hearing. We invited Mr. Price to be here to take part in this process. He doesn't appear to be here at the moment. I will say just on the record that typically, Mr. Cook, no? Typically speaking, and also it's now 11:41, so we're 41 minutes into our meeting. Typically, when we're at this posture of the proceeding, what I do, on behalf of the board is I explain to the respondent the process that we're going to be going through for the hearing. That is the burden on the Office of Government Ethics to prove its case, the procedures that are outlined in the rules, the role of the board, that we have a bifurcated existence, if you will, that works closely with the Office of Government Ethics until last week, or last month, rather, when we issued the notice of violation, and now we become an adjudicatory body, and therefore we are hands-off on the substance of what goes on until we actually have the hearing. But Mr. Grimaldi is our consigliere on this whole thing. There was no ethnic slur intended there with the last name of Spagnoletti. But
poor compliment.
There you go. But Mr. Grimaldi handles the communications with the parties for us in the run-up to the hearing. I would explain the procedures that are outlined in the rules. He's been given a copy of the rules along with the notice of violation. I would explain his rights to representation, discovery, his right to challenge the evidence, and the right to present his own evidence, and the order in which the evidence would be presented. We would also then talk about which we're about to talk about, which is the scheduling order. Normally, when the respondent comes to this part of the proceeding, and he's not required to come to this, but normally when he comes to this,
he did have notice.
And I understood he was going to be here from Mr. Grimaldi. But normally, we take this opportunity to work with him, with the respondent on dates to make sure that everything kind of works, because although we have the power to set them, we try to be as inclusive as possible with all the parties and everybody else. But he's not here. So in terms of steps, and I know OG is familiar with this, but I'll do this for the public record, what we will do is set a hearing date, and then I will also set a date by which the exhibits are to be presented to the board in advance of the hearing so that we have them and we can look at them before the board happens. I will then still allow OGE and Mr. Price to negotiate the other dates in the run-up to the hearing, dates which will include, among other things, the completion of discovery, the pre-hearing conference, the submission of the joint pre-hearing statement, motions in limine, and then, of course, identification of the exhibits. It is always more beneficial to be doing this collaboratively, but if we have to, we'll go ahead and set it. So therefore, Ms. Schwartz and Mr. Wade, if I may impose, although you're not formally a board member, but I do want to make sure, in anticipation of your arrival, this will work for you as well. Mr. Sobin, based on my reading of the notice of violation and based on what my understanding of the case is, would it be a reasonable assumption that this is probably a one full day hearing?
Yes.
Okay. So in other cases, we've done one of two things. Either we piggybacked it on an actual meeting date, which I don't think makes sense for a full day hearing, or we set, in one case, we had to set like a 2-week window because it literally went 2 weeks and wasn't done in that 2 weeks. But anyway, that case resolved. So I would ask Ms. Schwartz, and I think we should probably be aiming for like mid to late September. Is that right? Does that seem about right to you?
I mean,
October. October we have the symposium, which is. He's not here, so tell me what your preference is.
Well, because there's a personnel dimension to this.
Yes.
He is actively working. He has not been put on administrative leave.
Right.
But there is some concern.
There are employment consequences.
For, yes. And so, if there's evidence that he did something wrong, the agency want to know about it sooner rather than later. And so maybe late September would be too late. I think the agency involved would prefer it earlier.
I mean, late August?
Or early September.
Early September, either way.
I can't do, like the 4th, 3rd, 4th, 5th. I've got a family, something I have to be at. But after that, I could, starting. When's Labor Day this year? Does anybody know?
4th or 5th?
I could probably do it, you know, the 6th, maybe. Is that a...
Let's see. The 5th. Yeah, Labor Day is the 5th.
So maybe the 7th, 8th?
6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, that week, sometime during that week.
That's fine. I'm available. You want to
do the 8th?
Thursday the 8th. Is that our board meeting?
That's our board. Well, no, it actually, the board meeting's technically the first, September 1st.
First, right, it's the week before. I'm okay for the 8th. Mr. Wade?
That works.
Schwartz, yep. Okay. Let's set it for, we'll set it for the 8th. Or exhibits by the 1st, week before. And the rest of the dates you can work out. If you can't for some reason, by next Friday, the 22nd, if you could let Mr. Grimaldi know that either there's no agreement or that you've not been able to reach Mr. Price on the dates, please let Mr. Grimaldi know, and then we'll just go ahead and then give us your proposed dates that work for you.
Okay.
And then we'll go ahead and get them in order.
I have a request for technical purposes.
Yes.
It's always better for us to alert Octo that will be under constant recording status.
Well, that's you're anticipating my very next point.
Yes, so if you all could please notify this office if those dates change so that we can inform Octo well in advance to make sure that everything's tested, up and running, and that we're able to consistently record.
I was going to raise this very same issue. Thank you, Ms. Hughes. We have now done it two different ways. So we've either used a court reporter or not, as the case may be. And I'm going to leave it to the parties to make a decision about whether you want to do this. And the reason I raise this is because although we have this wonderful recording system so we can capture the video and the audio, and I'm confident we can get a full day out of it, the thing that we do not have is somebody other than you, Mr. Sobin, to administer the oath. And so, therefore, you will be placing not just your own witnesses, but you'll be placing any witnesses that Mr. Price happens to have under oath as well, which might be a little awkward for him and his witnesses.
I've already put him under oath once.
Well, and it resulted in NOV being issued. So I guess what I would say is I am comfortable that we are preserving a record that, if need be, goes to the Court of Appeals with this system. It can be transcribed. It's live. You are the only person in the room who has the power to put somebody under oath. I am personally comfortable with that. I guess what I would say is, in your discussions, hopefully, with Mr. Price, we've had this issue come up before, and then, like, who bears the cost and all that kind of stuff. If he wants to have a court reporter here in addition to the recording system, or for whatever reason you want to have it, that remains an option for him as well. I'm not saying he can't do it. I'm just pointing it out because it is now, we used to have somebody. We don't have to have somebody anymore.
Right. We are very expensive too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so I'm not saying that I think that we should have one. What I'm saying is that he needs to know that he has the option of having one. And
but would he have to pay?
It may have to be at his expense. And again, I'm going to leave that in the other case. I think do we split the cost or no?
We paid for the court reporter, but they had to pay for their own transcripts,
right? So, which is the expensive part of the whole thing. But to the extent that Mr. Price is willing to have a conversation about this, I would just at least raise it, because typically speaking, the respondents aren't thinking about that, and then they show up, and then the reality is you're swearing people in, and then there's no hard transcript. Someone's going to take this and turn it into one.
Right.
And then also, too, we provided a copy of that recording to opposing counsel.
Correct.
And we can do the same thing here. We just need to make sure that we're on the same page so we can make sure all the equipment is operating properly.
Absolutely.
Additionally, if there's going to be a requirement for more than the number of microphones that we have now, which are currently what you see on the dais here at the table, and then we've got one lavalier mic that hooks to the lapel, and we need to know that as well.
Right.
Okay, thanks.
No problem. All right. Is there anything else that we...
Amended notice of violation.
Oh, that's right. There was before the board is an amended notice of violation that makes some technical corrections to the NOV, just some typos on dates. I understand that was unopposed by Mr. Price. Is that right?
When we met with Mr. Price last, we discussed the motion with him, and he has since been served with it, and we have not heard from him since.
Okay.
So it is.
We actually did hear from him when he was served. He pointed out a typographical error in the motion itself, and so we have we'd like to correct that on the record right now. Instead of 2016, it should have been 2015. Item number 3 on the motion. And I think Mr. Grimaldi has an amended notice of violation for the board to consider and sign at this point.
I would vote to, I mean, it's a consent motion to amend the NOV. I would go ahead and vote to grant that.
Can I just ask what the explanation is for the amended that Mr. Grimaldi wants? It's not just a date change, it's something else.
They're just typos in the days, is that right?
They're typos.
Yes.
Oh, it's only the typos. There's so when you said the amended, it just includes that.
They're very technical.
Okay. It's just, okay, fine.
Right. And just so that everyone is aware, and just for the record, is that we'll talk more, and I would explain this all to Mr. Price if he were here. During the course of the proceedings itself, the board sits. The whole board sits. This is, I mean, at the moment, until we do some rule changes and kind of have a subset of us, is all of us. And then also I preside as the chairman, and we follow the rules of evidence generally speaking, although hearsay is permitted. But as part of the pre-hearing discussions and the pre-hearing order, we'll ask the parties to air any objections up front to the authenticity of particular documents. The relevance is always subject to what's going on in the hearing itself. But there's no reason to be arguing about whether a particular record is authentic or not, unless there's a real reason to be arguing about it. So. All right. Is there anything else in terms of the hearing and Mr. Price's matter that we need to address today?
Do you want a copy of the schedule order for us to enter the rest of the
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and do that?
And then after that's done, the parties can anticipate a pre-hearing order.
We've done these similarly before, that just expands on those dates and what needs to be in the pre-hearing statement and the rest. Ms. Petzelto, are you going to be presenting the case for OG?
Sorry, yes.
And as far as we know, as of when you last spoke with Mr. Price, he was not represented. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Anything else?
That concludes our public portion of our presentation.
Okay, very good. So at this point in our meetings, we always offer members of the public the opportunity to offer any comments, anything that they want to say about the matters before the board before we go to a closed non-public session to discuss, and I'll recite them in a minute, what we're going to be discussing. Anybody from the public? I think the only person we have is Mr. Wade and your colleague. No? Okay. Great. Well, we look forward to seeing you formally. And good luck at the swearing-in on Monday.
Absolutely. I'll be there by the
time. Terrific. Thank you very much. All right. At this time, I'll go ahead and entertain a motion to move the board to a non-public executive session for the purposes of discussing ongoing confidential investigations pursuant to DC Code 2-575B to deliberate on a decision in which the board will exercise quasi-judicial authority pursuant to DC Code 2-575B13 and personnel matters pursuant to 2-575B10.
So moved.
And I'll go ahead and second that since I have to. And all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
No one, none opposed. We'll go ahead. The time is 11:55. Thank you, everyone, for moving this along. Okay, so we are now back on the public record. It is 12:25. We only have one matter to report out from the closed session. That is that during the closed session today, the board voted to make an investigation public and formal relating to Councilmember Yvette Alexander, and we've authorized the Director of Government Ethics in his investigation of these complaints to issue subpoenas as required. So, and with that, we are now concluded. It is 12:26. Thank you.